Well, thank you for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen. Great to have you here. Henrik with Red Ice TV. Always a pleasure having you with us. Today, we have an interesting show for you lined up with Edward Dutton. He is a freelance researcher and a writer. We're going to be talking about his book, At Our Wits' End, How We Are Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future. I'm actually new to his work. I don't know that much about it. He wrote to me and wanted to come on to talk about this book. And he has a number of other ones as well that we're going to talk more about and mention later. But we're going to primarily stick today to At Our Wits' End and talk about that. A little bit from his bio. He was born in London in 1980. He lives in Finland and is an adjunct professor of the Anthropology of Religion at Oulu University. He was educated at Durham University, where he graduated in theology in 2002, and Aberdeen University, from which he received his PhD in religious studies in 2006. So thank you so much for coming on with us, Edward. It's great to have you here. Looking forward to this.
Hi, hello. Thank you for having me. Hello.
Wonderful. Thank you for contacting me, by the way. I don't know that much about your work, so I'm looking forward to getting into that. And of course, one of the things we want to talk about is why we are becoming less intelligent and what it means for the future. Very interesting book. I've skimmed through it and seems very, very interesting. Give us, if you will, just an introduction to your work and how you ended up writing this book.
Well, I started off studying religion, and I was very interested in fundamentalist Christianity and fundamentalism and that sort of thing. But the way in which you're taught, if you're in a humanities department at a British university, is entirely environmental. Every explanation is to do with environment. There's just no conception of anything being to do with genes or anything like that. And it was when I was, I suppose, after I came to Finland, I was kind of awakened to the importance of genes, and indeed the importance of genes in religion. Religiousness is about 40% genetic. And it correlates with seemingly genetically with health and these kinds of things. And so this got me interested then in this started to make me question rather the kind of things that I had been taught when I was at university. And this got me looking into the importance. I then did a project on Finnish culture and understanding Finnish culture. And that's when it really became clear to me that you can't just explain everything with environmental factors, a significant part of what's going on. If the heritability of intelligence is 80% and the heritability of personality is about 50%, then a significant part of differences between countries of why Finland is different from England is likely to be evolution and likely to be genetic factors. And so then this got me interested in the broader area of intelligence. And it was from there that I got involved with various research groups and started researching intelligence. And for me, the most interesting aspect of intelligence, quite apart from the social consequences of it or whatever, is this discovery, which is it's termed the Woodley effect, actually, after my colleague Michael Woodley, which is that intelligence is decreasing. And seemingly our intelligence has been decreasing for a very long time. And what that correlates with, of course, intelligence at the national level, national IQ, correlates with every measure of civilization that you can think of. And so our fundamental thesis is that until the Industrial Revolution, until 1800, we were under conditions of harsh, purifying Darwinian selection for intelligence. We were like animals. We were under selection for intelligence. And we know that because intelligence correlates robustly with wealth, with how much money you earn. And we know that the wealthier 50% of the population had double, 100%, double the fertility of the poorer 50% of the population in pre-modern times. We know that from wills, we know that from christening records and so on. And you can watch through time in terms of per capita innovations, in terms of all kinds of other measures. You can watch what this means because of the heritability of IQ being so, intelligence being so high at about 80%, is that intelligence is going up and up and up and up every generation. It's that process is bootstrapping the population. It's a population of social descent. Everybody moves, the people at the bottom die out, and the people who are one step up move down to fill the place that they have vacated in the social hierarchy. And that's why every English person, this is a statistical fact, every native English person is descended from King Edward III. anyway, who was a king in the 14th century. Anyway, so this carries on until the Industrial Revolution, and then it starts to change. That's the fundamental breakthrough. That's the fundamental breakthrough when we start to inoculate children, that sort of thing, so we have better medicine. And this, we had child mortality in 1800 was about 40%, but it wasn't 40% across the society. It was tiny among the wealthy because they could create better conditions for their children and that kind of thing and better medicine. And it was massive among the poor. And this, of course, stopped that situation. So wealth was no longer predicting fertility to the same extent. And then you had other factors that developed because of the Industrial Revolution, such as contraception, which was taken up first by the upper class and kind of seeped down. And using contraception is associated, the ability to use it correctly and to use it at all, indeed, is associated with intelligence. And then there are other factors as well that are involved. And this has led to a reversal in the association between intelligence and fertility. And now how many children you have is negatively correlated with your intelligence, and intelligence is going down. And we've demonstrated this based not just on IQ tests, but that's a more complex thing and it's a more recent phenomenon that scores on them are going down, but on measures of intelligence which can be used across time. The problem with an IQ test is that people can get better at them, and so it's not a very good measure across time. But with measures that are invariant across time, things like reaction times are getting longer, and reaction times are associated with intelligence. Color discrimination is getting worse. Color discrimination is associated with intelligence. And most importantly, there are certain alleles, certain genes, which are associated with high intelligence, and the population, the percentage of populations that have these is going, the percentage of the population that has these is decreasing across generations. So it means we're getting less intelligent, and we're getting less intelligent for genetic reasons. And that's the essential argument of the book. And then we look in more detail at why it's happening and what can perhaps be done about it.
Right. And of course, this is a disaster for civilization. It's a disaster for many, many different reasons, obviously. There's kind of a, I don't know if you ever saw it, but there's a dumbed down version of what you just explained, which is the movie Idiocracy. They have a really good clip in the beginning. Did you ever see that movie? It's actually by the guy who did Beavis and Butthead. He basically explains just what you said, but in a kind of really funny way of how...
I haven't seen it. No, I was on Italian television on Saturday night. They interviewed me about the decline of intelligence, and I saw the clip, and they began it with this Idiocracy.
There you go.
But no, I haven't seen it, and I suspect that the problem with it is, at least from what I've seen of clips, is they imply that there's a relatively technological society happening, but with lots of stupid people doing stupid things. But that wouldn't happen, because the ability to sustain a highly technological society is underpinned, A, by the average IQ of the society, which means more people can work together and less things go wrong, and less little things go wrong, and those things kind of snowball. And that's why if you go to somewhere like India or whatever, it's chaos, because the average IQ is low. And B, by the IQ of the smart faction, of the outlier, high IQ kind of geniuses, basically, who come up with brilliant things and are able to solve very difficult problems. Now, if both of those go down, you wouldn't be able to sustain a technological society. Obviously, you'd go backwards. And you'd see something like you see in post-colonial Africa. You literally see standards of living going backwards, and you see people unable to do things they used to be able to do. Now, it could be argued, and we suggest this in the book, that our inability to get Concorde back in the sky is perhaps a consequence of our average IQ decreasing, meaning that more little things go wrong and we can't trust in the way we used to be able to trust those things not to go wrong, so we daren't put Concorde back in the sky. And equally, we suggest that the failure to go back to the moon since the 70s could be perhaps a consequence of that. It's just too difficult. Certainly, if you look in everyday life, there are various factors that correlate with intelligence. Intelligent people are higher in trust. For example, they're higher in trust because intelligent people are better able to empathize. They're better able to think what it's like to be somebody else. And they're therefore, they will be trusting themselves. They will be trustworthy, and they assume other people are trusting. Now, trust is something that's declined and declined and declined in recent decades, trust in other people. There are other factors behind that, but that would be consistent with intelligence going down. the one thing we have actually is measures of vocabulary usage. It's one very interesting measure, which is that if you look at our vocabulary compared to the past, our vocabulary is better because we're all more educated and we're all reading more and using the internet and so on. But our use of high order words are thinking tools. Words show the ability to think in a complex way, and therefore high order, difficult words show the ability to think in a very complex way. Our use of those complex words is going down over time, based on analyses of literature using Google Ngram. And we're now back, I think I'm right in saying, at the level of about 1700. So 100 years before the Industrial Revolution allowed us to reach what was probably our peak IQ. So this is telling you kind of what's going on. And in terms of per capita genius, so per capita recognized brilliant inventions, the really breakthrough inventions, we're back at the level we were in about 1600.
Oops.
So, you know, you can trace this rise and fall of civilization across time. And in the book, we traced it with Rome. We traced per capita innovations with Rome. And of course, you find that the per capita innovations go up. They reach a peak round about the time of Christ. And then they start to decline. And Rome starts to decline. And you get other parallels of this. Democracy, for example, tends to be associated with high intelligence because democracy involves trust, the need to trust people. It involves organization. It involves the ability to suppress emotion and being really angry about your opponent winning. It involves all these kinds of intelligent aspects. Rome was a democracy just before the time of Christ. But that, you know, 100 years or so before the time of Christ. But gradually that democracy was debased. And Rome became a dictatorship, and that's what you predict would happen, that you'd fall into dictatorship. So yeah, that's pretty much it. It would imply that society will gradually start to go backwards, and I think you're seeing evidences already. The only thing is that because we've got this industrial revolution, we've built up a kind of capital, and all we have to do to sustain that capital is minor tinkering.
Yeah, it's momentum in that, right? And it takes a long time for a civilization to fall. It just doesn't happen overnight, right?
I think that's a very good metaphor for it. There's a momentum that it sets off, and so it's like being pulled back by a catapult and thrust forward. And it takes time for you, even if you're getting stupider and stupider and stupider. It takes time for that thrust, that acceleration to run out so that the consequences become clear.
The effects of this, I think, today is less likely to see as well, because we do have some mechanization. We do even have some automation already, right? I mean, so the question is will we be able to reach a point where, for example, artificial intelligence and other kinds of automation will be at the point where it can start mending and tending to itself and don't even need their human handlers, right? Because that would be, not that that would be a solution to the problem. Sooner or later, things break down, just as you say, but it might still be able to carry us a little bit further, as opposed to if we didn't have all this, all the artificial intelligence or the automation, the robotics, etc., right?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, it would be like, let's say, a very wealthy old person who earned a lot of money in their life, having enough money to get a full-time carer. And that carer being able to look after them for a very long time before the money finally ran out. So it would, perhaps that's a reasonable metaphor for it. It would extend the shelf life, as it were, of civilization.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the capital, it's the nature of the capital we'd have to start, unless we changed our lifestyle, because we would be making fewer and fewer innovations, and fewer major innovations. Eventually, the capital would start, the capital, as it were, would start to run out. And when that happens, you start to go backwards.
Yeah, now let's talk about the driver of this. That's interesting. You explained some of it already. I think there's much more there that we can actually analyze and look into in detail. I have always had a sneaking feeling, a suspicion, in terms of the fact that the success that we have accomplished with industrialization, etc., has obviously made us also weaker at the same time. Ironically, our success is leading us to become more vulnerable over time, right? Because we're subjected to less pressures. It's a kind of a very high standard of living. There's even comfort in that to a certain extent, which causes most humans to not take as much risks. We don't have to. We don't have to try to become individuals that are explorers, go above and beyond, etc. Right? There's a lot of different reasons for why this is happening. But what would you say about that in terms of that it's the success, and maybe that's why it's cyclical too, right? That it's, yeah. You know, we come up to a certain point, and due to the fact that we reach that point, it's almost ironically like it's a kind of a natural selection that comes in anyway on top of that, if you see what I'm saying.
Perhaps we die out. Yeah, I think, I mean, if you look at ancient Rome or even ancient Greece, they commented on the fact that once they reached a very high level of civilization, the upper class stopped breeding.
Yeah.
Upper class, who tend to be the most intelligent, stop having children. And this was commented on in contemporary documents. And they tried to bring in incentives to incentivize the upper class to have more children, but it didn't work. And the reason for it, I suspect, is that the level of child mortality would have not been particularly high among the upper class, because there would have been child mortality, obviously, but it wouldn't have been as high among the rest of society. And their levels of luxury basically were very, very high. Their levels of stress in this highly civilized society were very, very low. Now, one of the predictors, one of the correlates of stress is religiousness. If you are relatively highly stressed, you tend to be religious, and religiousness tends to sanctify as the will of God evolutionarily useful adaptations. It tends to tell you that your society is unique and your society is the best in the world and your society should expand and you should pass on your genes and you should go forth and multiply and you should make sure your group expands and conquers conquers whatever. That's particularly Judeo-Christian religion, but also other pagan religions do the same kind of thing. And so once you become very, very low in stress, then your level of religiousness and the likelihood that you'll believe in God declines. And so then you've got a leadership in society who aren't particularly religious. And so then this is going to disincentivize expansion. It's going to disincentivize even protecting your own society from the enemy at the gate, because you won't think that you're the best anymore.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that happened in Rome. I mean, the people at the gates of Rome said, well, look, we're Christians, you're Christians, you should let us in. And of course they did, because this sense of superiority that was underpinned by the sort of pagan cult or whatever of saying that they were the superior people, that was gone.
It was like a noble savage, right? We've heard that in modern times, right? But they had it back then too. They even proposed this, that it was kind of and partially they were correct, ironically, that it was a vigor that, for example, the Goths came with, right? They brought something back into them that they actually lacked, right?
Indeed, and there was an Islamic philosopher in the medieval period called Ibn Khaldun, and he had this concept of asabiyyah, and he argued that basically that societies start under essentially conditions of very, very strong purifying Darwinian selection for being, as it were, group selected, being highly ethnocentric, positively ethnocentric, they think they're the best, and so on, negatively ethnocentric, they hold outsiders in contempt. And it is that rigor, that vigor, and also that intelligence that's being selected for that builds up the society, and the religiousness that's being selected for builds up the society. They manage to create luxury and so on. They become lower in SWR. They become decadent. The upper class stop breeding. And often, of course, as well, when societies reach this level of luxury, as happened in Rome, they develop contraception. And when that happens, it's the more intelligent and tend to take up contraception, because the more intelligent have the greater sufficient impulse control to use it. And also they just take it up first. And so then the enemy at the gate comes along, and he is higher in asabiyyah. He is higher in vigor. He may not be higher in intelligence necessarily. Well, he may be, but certainly he'll be higher in asabiyyah and in ethnocentrism. And he comes in and invades.
Yeah.
And then the process starts, and then the process continues all over again. And I think that's a reasonable cyclical theory of history. And it could be argued that if it didn't happen, if our intelligence became too high, there's some evidence that very high intelligence correlates with, really, we don't look at this in the book, but it correlates really with kind of autism traits. So people that have super high intelligence, they have problems, firstly, because they're outliers. And if they're outliers, you have a problem dealing with the rest of society anyway, because you're different from them. But secondly, part of intelligence involves solving problems. Color discrimination correlates with intelligence for very good reason, because the more subtle is the information you can take in, the more information you can take in, the better able you are to solve a problem. And these people who are highly intelligent tend to be basically hypersensitive, because they're taking in huge amounts of information. And so they're very sensitive to noise, and they're very sensitive to light. And often intelligence also correlates with intellect, with being interested in ideas and things like this. And often people that are highly intelligent are so narrow in their intelligence as well. The more intelligent people become, the weaker is the positive manifold between the different kinds of intelligence, let's say mathematical, linguistic, and spatial. I mean, this is why Einstein was a fantastic mathematician, completely brilliant man, but he had no spatial intelligence and used to get lost. As we look at in the book, he'd get lost in Princeton, New Jersey, and have to wander into shops and say, hello, I'm Einstein, can you help me get home, please?
Yeah.
And so if you become too skewed in your intelligence, you often, these people that are very intelligent, sort of Sheldon Cooper types, they've no social skills, they can't get on with people.
Yeah.
And so if society's too intelligent, it's screwed, basically. So there's good reasons why intelligence has to work in cycles.
Yeah, because and there's a really interesting point, because it's almost like, yeah, you would wonder, or you realize also then that intelligence isn't everything, right? Because if it was, then surely they would be intelligent enough to continue reproducing themselves, or even realize that it's up to the intelligence to the intelligent classes to continue to ensure that they still have many kids and whatnot. And that doesn't seem to happen. If you say it's a kind of a specialization that seems to occur, and it gets narrow and narrow and narrower. And then over time, of course, you have the ability, I guess, the success too, again, of society collectively, medicine, industrialization, hygiene, etc., that enables the less intelligent to also have more kids, and that more of those kids do survive, right? And if you go back way back, you had a natural selection where someone could, like, let's say, aim for having three kids, but they had to have eight because, you know, five didn't make it. And it kind of had this realization. But as Western medicine has come in and other items, take Africa, for example, right, then we've been able to lift them up to a position where many more of their kids, their intended kids, actually survive and increases in their population numbers, right?
And there's a lag. There's often a lag as well. So you'll see this people are increasingly interested in the UK anyway, in genealogy. There's been these TV programs, Who Do You Think You Are? And things like this. I don't know if there have been. In America, there was a version as well. I don't know if there was in Sweden. But one of the things that they find is that you'll find if you've got working class ancestors who were born in, like, say, 1890, they'll have loads of kids. They'll have sort of six kids, because they haven't yet fully computed that all those kids will survive. There's a lag in realizing, and it takes them until, let's say, those kinds of people till the 50s to realize they can just have a couple of kids. No one's going to die.
Yeah.
Whereas the English upper class at the time, those born 1890, they would typically have a couple of children. And because there was no way, it was quite clear to them that it was extremely unlikely that any of their children were going to die. The result of better medicine, the result of the spread of contraception, and also other factors. Feminism is one we could talk about as well, and immigration,
yes.
Welfare state. But is that the correlation between intelligence and fertility that is reversed? And suddenly it is those of low intelligence that are, as it were, doing Darwin's work and who are the future. I mean, if you're talking about welfare in England now, if you divide this in the old days, welfare was something that was the idea was you'd never want to do it. You'd never want to go to the workhouse. People would do anything to avoid going to the workhouse. And then once they got rid of the workhouse and they brought in a basic welfare, it was very basic. It was just enough to live off. It wasn't a lifestyle. Nobody would consider having a child while on welfare. If they did, it would be an accident, and they certainly wouldn't be able to have a few of them. They certainly wouldn't want to live off it.
And even if they did, remember, like Sweden did, if you did end up in that situation, they actually sterilized a lot of those people. All right, we get a lot of crap for that today. We hear about that, how we were like National Socialist or something in our eugenics ability. But there is there still need to be pointed out that there was a smart, logical, scientific approach to something like that, where they realize that if we need to have a healthy population, genetic fitness, etc., we need to be in a position where we make sure that the higher intelligence reproduce, and that those that are less capable of doing so, we lessen their ability to reproduce, right?
Well, no, indeed. And what happened to Sweden? And when was it? 1932. When was it that the SDP came into power? I can't remember what year it was. It was early 30s, I think.
Yeah.
But then they were essentially in power continuously until like 70 or something.
Yeah.
It's just disastrous in so many ways. But that's another issue. But with welfare now in England, if you divide the population into those who were both parents, families where both parents are working, which is the more intelligent ones, families where only one parent is working and one's on welfare, and families where both are on welfare, which is the less intelligent ones, it's only that latter category that are breeding at above replacement fertility. And this was demonstrated in a book called by Adam Perkins of King's College London, called The Welfare Trait, which the mainstream media have, of course, not reported on in any great detail. And this is a crucial finding. So the welfare state essentially encourages those who have IQ really below 80, I think. That's to be unemployable, below 80, to procreate in substantial numbers. And then another issue, apart from conception, is simply feminism, which is in days of yore, women if they had a middle class job and they got married, then they would lose their job, And so there didn't tend to be a particular pressure against them in terms of having children if they got married. But now the more educated, the less educated female will be, you know, drop out of school at 18 or whatever and go and get some job. And then she'll be becoming a mother by the time she's 19, 20 or whatever. And she'll end up often being a grandmother by the time she's maybe 38, which is when her more intelligent contemporaries will be thinking about having children, having all of their 20s and maybe even the first half increasingly of their 30s to their careers. And then often they find that it's too late or they can't find the right man. I mean, and that brings in another problem, which is that females tend to want to marry hypergamously. They are evolved to sexually select for status in a way that men aren't, because under evolutionary pressures, if you were sexually selected for status, then the male, which was polygamous, of course, the male will be more likely to invest in your children and look after them. So that's what they're evolved to do. And they often, if they're highly educated, if they have a doctorate or something, they won't find many men who are left, who are interested in them. And those men will tend to select the youth, of course, as well. And so they can't, and often indeed very high intelligence, the most intelligent females don't have children at all. So it's another factor involved here, that feminism is, and this critique of the traditional society, whether it's feminism, whether it's religion. I mean, religiousness is correlated with fertility. Religious people tend to have more children. Partly this may be because they have, as it were, more normal genes. I mean, they would have, we're selected to be religious. I look at this in a paper I did called "The Mutant Says in His Heart There Is No God." They have more normal genes. This is my YouTube page. So therefore, it's religiousness that would have been selected for. It's religiousness that would have been the norm under evolution. And therefore, you'd expect religiousness to correlate with a low mutational load and therefore with normal desires and other things that would have been selected for. And atheism, as I showed in this paper, correlates with left-handedness, which is a sign often of mutation and mutational load. It correlates with physical and mental illness, physical asymmetry and all kinds of other things which imply mutation. So that's one reason. Another reason is simply that a lot of what religion is about is really sanctifying and thus amplifying the likelihood of occurring evolutionarily adaptive forms of behavior, such as having children. So all these factors have come together to create a perfect storm whereby intelligence is negatively associated with religiousness, with fertility. And in the book, as I say, we set out in detail all of the evidence for this and look at all of the counter arguments that are presented. And one of them is this ludicrous idea, which has been presented by a woman called Barbara Demino or something. She's a Welsh woman who's an academic in France. And she's written this book called Toxic Cocktail. And she argues that we're becoming less intelligent because of sort of plastics and endocrine disrupting things in the environment.
Well, that's feminizing. Nothing to do with IQ, though.
it's also absolute rubbish, because we know, we've got data from Iceland which proves that over the last three generations, the percentage of the population with these alleles that are associated with high IQ has gone down. And also we know that the negative Flynn effect, so the Flynn effect is IQ scores going up across the 20th century, negative since about 1997, based on army data from Sweden and Finland and Norway and also other data, IQ scores are going down. And we know that they're going down on the increases were on the more environmentally sensitive aspects of the test. Because intelligence, I mean, it's a little bit like height. You know, you have environmentally sensitive aspects of height, like how long your legs are. That's environmentally sensitive. So in the old days, we were shorter than we are now because we didn't have good food and we had short legs. And you have genetically heavily influenced aspects of height, i.e. how long your trunk is. And it's the same with intelligence. You have aspects of intelligence which are highly environmentally sensitive, such as how good you are at, like, I don't know, thinking in a highly analytic way or something like that. We call them specialized abilities. And then you have these highly genetic things. And it was the specialized abilities that were increasing across the 20th century. And it's the genetic components of intelligence that are now decreasing on these tests, on these army tests.
Yeah.
So we know it's for genetic reasons. And so what happened was that it's called, my colleague calls it the it's basically a dual system, a co-occurrence model, he calls it, whereby our general intelligence, which is highly genetic, is going down, but these environmental, highly environmentally influenced specialized abilities are going up because of the highly sort of scientific environment we've created for ourselves, which pushes these abilities to their absolute maximum phenotypic limit. And what this means, because of the limitations of the IQ test, is that it comes, because it's not 100% measuring IQ, measuring intelligence, I'm sorry, is that it comes across as an IQ increase, even though general intelligence is going down. But once the phenotypic maximum of, that's possible for this narrow ability that's highly environmentally sensitive is reached, then the underlying genetic decline will start to poke through, even on the IQ tests. And that's not what we've been seeing since 1997 in the Finnish data, in the Swedish data, in the Norwegian data, and in various other data sets.
Now, if there is this rise and fall that seems cyclical, it's kind of a natural, to a certain extent, a natural cycle. Would you say that the what about the arc over time, though? Because at the same time, it seems every time that we do have an increase in intelligence, we do reach, and I don't know if this is just due to technology or what it is, but it seems like we reach higher and are capable to do more each time that we're on the high, right?
Yeah, this is what Vico, the Italian philosopher, this is what he argued. He argued that with the rise and fall of civilizations, you get more each time, presumably because aspects of the previous civilization are preserved.
Right.
So a good example of this is that obviously you have the Greek and Roman civilization and so on, and then they collapse, and the West is in a dark age. While it's in a dark age, there's Islamic civilization, and Islamic civilization is able to piggyback on this Greek and Roman stuff, which is preserved in the East, and then we in the West went during the Crusades and so on, we rediscover this stuff, and particularly then during the Renaissance, we compute the full importance of it, and therefore there's loads of stuff that's been done that we don't have to redo. Now similarly, if the Great Fire in the library in Alexandria, whatever, hadn't happened, then they'd think of all the other stuff that perhaps you wouldn't
exactly
have.
Yeah.
I mean, we lost the knowledge of contraception. We literally lost it. We didn't know how to make effective contraception. We lost the knowledge because we were highly religious and because we'd inherited a Jewish prohibition on contraception and so on. And so we just lost the knowledge. And that could have been written down in Alexandria, who knows. And there may be lots of other things like that. So it follows that we've got further this time. And thus, even if we collapse backwards, there will be certain things which will be preserved, you know, computers or whatever, which future civilizations will be able to revive, and therefore they'll be able to go further. So that's one thing to be positive about, I think. And we argue in the book that we can't, I mean, a lot of our people that have read the book kind of write to us and they don't agree with this, and they say, oh, there should be a policy of eugenics, and that, you know, that would help to sort the situation out. But I think what we suggest is that the problem with that is it would almost certainly cause revolution and war. People, you know, the kind of mutant, maladapted types that lead us at the moment in the world would leap upon this and you know, cause those who are being told they can't breed to rise up, and there'd be a war. And wars are inherently dysgenic, and we've got data on this from World War II. We know that the IQ of the British Army in 1939 was higher than it was in 1945. Because cleverer people tend to be killed in war, because they tend to be officers, and officers are cleverer than the troops, and they tend to be brave and self-sacrificing, and therefore get themselves killed.
Yeah.
And so war is dysgenic, and it would cause war. We don't want war. Therefore, the only thing I could think of that could possibly work. Also, the other problem with it is that if you had a policy of eugenics, then there'd still be mutational load building up. Even so, a mutational load ultimately interferes with intelligence, unless you were also selecting for health, as well as genetic health, as well as intelligence. And so the only way you could do it would be to just go back to pre-1800 conditions, where 40% of children died before they reached adulthood. And you'd have to be pretty heartless to do that. And I can't see that working. And so, I mean, the one benefit of industrialization, like, really, is that people don't have to go through the tragedy that so many of our ancestors did of losing a child.
But this is a very interesting point. This is a very interesting discussion, because the way I see it is that we are simply pushing off the inevitable. that at some stage you are going to have the system as it exists now, I think, collapsing, right? Again, it would be that, can we reach this cusp of, I don't know, artificial intelligence, self-improving robots, they build themselves, etc., that somehow we become some second-class citizen, I guess, to them or something, you know, or they take care of us or something like that. But otherwise, what we're looking at is a kind of a colony collapse at some point, I think, that if we don't take the hard decisions to make sure that we are moving, that we are improving ourselves. And I'm not talking about becoming cyborgs or computer brain interfaces. I'm talking about improving ourselves naturally, the natural way. Then I think that we are going to hit the wall sooner or later. And at this stage, we're going to, I mean, how many billions of people are there on the planet? And when technology, farming, or any of these things fail, there's going to be a mass catastrophe on a scale that we've never seen before.
You think that the population of England in about 1650, it was somewhere in the region of 6 or 7 million.
Yeah.
Now it's 65 million. So that means that under conditions of Darwinian selection, pre-industrial revolution, 10% of people that are in England at the moment would be healthy enough to probably to survive.
Yeah.
So that means that the other 90%. Are mutants, essentially, I mean, who have all kinds of mutations, poor immune systems being the main one, which would mean that they wouldn't survive. But mutations, as my colleague Michael Woodley has argued in a paper that he's done, mutations of the mind, of the body, tend to be comorbid with mutations of the mind, because 84% or more of our genome is the brain. And so as we have this rise in mutation, we're going to have a rise in people carrying what my colleague calls spiteful mutations, which will make you maladaptive, basically, will make you think in a maladaptive way, such as that you shouldn't have children, or that you shouldn't help your own genetic interests by helping your ethnic kin or whatever. And then these will have problems for those who run into you, who even don't carry the mutations, because you're going to influence them and therefore potentially make them think in a maladaptive way. So it would spread like a kind of contagion. And this is what he argues. You know, we are under Darwinian conditions, we are adapted as a normal, genetically normal people to be with other normal, genetically normal people. If we're not with those people, it starts to mess up the delicate equilibrium of the superorganism. And so it seems to me that it would therefore, you end up with a society which to some extent has a death wish.
Yeah, but that's what we're seeing. And
there are a few of us, you know, non-mutants like me or you, perhaps, that want to do something about this. But there's so few of us, and so I fear that it would be very, very difficult to institute anything, and it will become increasingly difficult with time as well, unless there was some sort of massive war which caused people to be deeply stressed and thus more religious. And you know, that kind of thing. And that, by the way, happened with World War II. It's unsurprisingly, level of church attendance spiked in World War I, and then went down again and spiked in World War II. I mean, that's what happens if you're under genuine stress. You become more religious, which is useful, because religiousness is correlated with ethnocentrism, so it's very useful in a war situation. But I suspect that the best thing we can hope to do is to go as far as we can, and also knowledge storage, to make sure that as much of this is stored in a way that of what we found that will survive as possible, so that when civilization rises again, which it inevitably will, because we will go back, as it collapses, we will go back to conditions of harsh selection, then they can get further next time. But I'm entirely open to, and I hope we can come up with a solution which avoids that happening. But history is not on our side in terms of that. Civilizations tend to be cyclical, and they tend to rise and fall. And there is no reason why ours won't rise and fall. But what we can plan for it to make it better. I mean, it's like if I say to you, you're going to get old one day and you're going to die. You don't turn around and say, oh, life's pointless, might as well kill myself. The tendency is to want to carry on, but to plan for being old, so that being old is less crap than it could be. And
right.
That's certainly something we could think about. We could think about the fact that we're getting old, as a civilization, and we have to think about what we can do to avoid the really bad things that happen when you get old, such as losing control of your car and crashing into somebody.
Yeah. What about the frequency of this? Because it seems also with technology, with communication, I guess we should say, and transportation. On top of that, it seems that the rise and fall cycle goes quicker and quicker as well. And even the mutation that you talked about, if we can look at this from the point of view of, let's say, mental disease or illness, right? That people that are they have these ideas which are anti-nature and goes against the natural order, if you want to put it that in simplistic terms. They now have an ability that we've never seen before historically to spread these ideas to others through social media and through publishing and all these kinds of things, right?
There's a fundamental difference, which is between our civilization and all other civilizations, which is that all other civilizations, high civilizations that we know of, developed contraception when they were on the cusp of an industrial revolution, really, or you know, just before it. They developed contraception in the equivalent of, I don't know, 1700, let's say, whereas it took us longer. And it took us longer for a number of reasons. Firstly, we inherited Christianity at a point where it was influenced by Judaism, and so there was a particularly strong taboo on the use of contraception. That's the first reason. And the second reason is that for various reasons, I look at this in a paper I did with my Swedish colleague at the University of Umeå, Guy Madison, and we look at execution. And we show that execution, the fact that we executed across the medieval period, basically 2% of the population every generation, and that 2% was basically psychopathic males, and those and stupid males. And so that would have made us more cooperative, more ethnocentric, and more intelligent. It would have contributed to us elevating our intelligence. But it also would have elevated our religiousness. And we show this, we actually chart it and statistically prove that it made us more religious. And it's one of the factors behind the Reformation happening when it did. And so we were very, very religious. We were much more religious than previous populations, which is why we did things like burn heretics at the stake and that sort of thing. And so, therefore, these factors, the Judaism aspect and the fact that we were so religious, that it was selected for because of that, because of the Black Death probably as well. Also because of the fact that it got particularly cold. That's another factor that's relevant. So you have this very cold period from the sort of late medieval period onwards. It's really cold. And so this is selecting heavily for intelligence, but also for cooperation and group selection and therefore religion. Because religion elevates group selection, elevates ethnocentrism. And so all of this comes together to mean that we're very, very religious. And so therefore it takes us longer to lose our religiousness such that we can start using contraception. So that's the unique difference between us and these civilizations. And therefore we have, unlike them, the Industrial Revolution, and therefore this mutational load, which would have been relatively small at the fall of Greece, let's say, or the fall of Rome, can become larger and larger and larger and larger. The population bigger and bigger and bigger, and more people that wouldn't survive under Darwinian conditions do survive until you get what we see today. And then, of course, you're quite right. You get a snowball effect whereby as we become more technologically capable, these maladapted people that want to set up websites and persuade other people to kill themselves or you know, how they can be more successful anorexics or all this other sick garbage that is spread online is probably more than enough to overwhelm the positive side of it, which is that there are shows like this that can counter the nonsense that we're told by the mainstream media. Spread. I mean, you have epidemics now of girls in England, you know, kind of groups of girls who all declare that at the same time that they are non-binary, and they do so at girls' schools when the girls' schools don't know what to do about it. And of course, they can't say, "Oh, well, it's a girls' school, so you're expelled because you're not a girl anymore. Get out." And so they have to do things like adapt their school uniforms. And it seems that the same kind of girls psychologically that are doing that are the girls that a generation earlier would have been anorexics. And the correlates are the same, interestingly, which is girls that are high in autism and high in markers of testosterone, interestingly. 2D-4D ratio, for example, is a mark of testosterone. They did a study that found that these girls have more male hands. Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course.
They can't get on with people. They don't have a firm sense of self. And so they give these weird things. They get a sense of control through anorexia, or they get a sense of control through asserting they're different. So these are serious problems, which you would predict based on a complete breakdown, a meltdown of normal society, because we're no longer selecting out mental and physical maladaptations.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes. I want to continue talking more about this in the second hour and go into some of these things. And as you said, it seems to all kind of converge at the same time. And one thing is feeding into another and exacerbating it. And at the same time, talking about religiosity, and we'll get into detail on this in the second part, but there seems to be also then a rise of kind of superstition, for the lack of a better term, I don't know what else to call it, at the same time, which many of these factions kind of seem to develop, which is another aspect to a kind of religiosity. And so I want to talk with you more about that. But tell us where people can go to get a copy of the book. If people want to follow you, you're on Twitter, you do have a YouTube channel. Give us some details about this.
I'm on Twitter at Jolly Heretic, and then my YouTube channel is, which is being shown now, is The Jolly Heretic, and I try to put a video once a week on various issues related to various sort of controversial issues in science, really, that people tend not, we're told not to touch. And then you can buy the, I've got a website, which I think Henry put up earlier, and then you can buy the book, I mean, just buy it on Amazon. There may be some shops that stock it, but I mean, you might as well just buy it on Amazon. And then I have other books on there as well, which may interest you, and I'm writing various things at the moment. So yeah, and if you want to fund me, if you're really nice, then you'll find a link to my Patreon page on below the YouTube videos and whatever. But I'm just buying Amazon. I think that's the way to go these days, really.
Yeah, we'll have links down below, ladies and gentlemen. Check that out. Also, I don't know if we're going to have time to talk about this time. I think we might do a second show about this, which is very interesting, which is obviously related to what we're talking about now, how to judge people by what they look like, right? It's counterintuitive to most of the things that we've ever heard. We hear we should never judge a book by its cover, but maybe we should. There is some truth to that, after all. But we'll see if we can talk about that maybe at the end of part two, if we have covered everything we want to do. But yeah, definitely check it out. Make sure you follow Edward on Twitter, and of course, check out the YouTube channel. All links down below. But we'll take a short break. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Part two coming right up after this. Hope you enjoyed the first part of this. We're going to continue in part two at redicemembers.com, as we do with most of our interview shows. We have an exclusive part two for our members. If you like what we do, definitely check it out. Helps us as well, of course, and you get a lot of original content that we don't upload to our YouTube channel or elsewhere. So definitely check it out, including Weekend Warrior. We have a lot of exclusive video content. redicemembers.com. Get a subscription, check it out, get a 3-month one, try it out, see what you think. To everyone joining us at the member site, thank you so much for supporting us. We'll be right back with part two. See you on the other side of this break.